Do you need a break?
You read my mind.
Come with me.
Hello and welcome to another episode of The Break. I'm your host, Father Roderick. In case you don't know me or you forgot about me, I'm a priest and I'm a geek, and I love to share with you everything that I'm passionate about, from movies, TV shows, video games, books, to cooking, to technology, to AI and the future of media. All that and more coming up in this show. Enjoy! This episode is brought to you thanks to my wonderful Patreon community. If you go to patreon.com/FatherRoderick, you can help me to bring these shows to you and to so many other people in the world. I'm a priest. I don't get paid for this work, so I rely on the generosity of my sponsors to be able to continue this ministry. So if you want to support me and you want to join an amazing community, get access to my Discord server, take a look at patreon.com/FatherRoderick.
How do you not like movies?
They're predictable. Like, the guy gets the girl and that kid sees dead people and Darth Vader is Luke's father.
Not liking movies is like not liking puppies.
They're fine. I just get bored and never make it to the end.
You know, you need a movie education. You need a moviecation. I'm going to give it to you.
All right, let's talk Spider-Man. I finally watched Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse, which was the sequel to the incredible animated Spider-Man movie Into the Spider-Verse. And I now understand that this is just the middle movie. There's going to be another movie that's a sequel to Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse. Now, Into the Spider-Verse was an amazing movie. I am a huge fan of Spider-Man. It's one of my favorite Marvel superheroes. I was so glad that Sony allowed Disney to produce their own Marvel Spider-Man movies, to bring Spider-Man into the MCU. It really was a gaping hole, and I'm so glad that that they did this, because those newer Spider-Man movies really, I think, hit the mark. But of course, Sony still has the trademark, or the franchise, how do you call it, like the IP. They have the rights to the character of Spider-Man, and in order to keep those rights, I think they're obliged to produce Spider-Man related movies from time to time. Now, that can result in creative movies like Madam Web. That movie just doesn't get out of my mind. It's so bad that I keep thinking about it every day. I don't have that with any other superhero movie. It's insane. I must have listened now to at least 10 podcasts that review and analyze why this movie is what it is. It's really not good. I don't want to encourage you, but if you want to have like the superhero equivalent of a tune, a song that is stuck in your head, you have that sometimes, right? This one song or melody or part of a song, and it's just stuck and it's on repeat. I have that from time to time. Well, the movie equivalent of that is, for me, is Madam Web. But I think they had to do this movie to fulfill their obligations in retaining the rights to the Spider-Man related universe. But they also created an amazing movie called Into the Spider-Verse, which was unlike anything we've ever seen in animation. And even if you didn't like Spider-Man, you would still be in awe of what they pulled off. What was incredibly creative was that they used the story where Spider-Man is actually traveling through the different dimensions of the multiverse, in this case, kind of the Spider-Man-related multiverse. They use that to introduce a ton of different types of animation, because all these worlds would not only have their own Spider-Man and their own, timeline, but they would also have their own style. And some of these worlds would be, I don't know, in black and white, or in a garish, like, 1980s style, or in a very futuristic style. Some of them would be 3D, some 2D. And they continued this in this next installment of the Spider-Verse, and it became even more frenetic. So this particular story takes place in the Earth version 1610. So they have numbers for each different reality. So Earth 1610, that is the Earth on which Miles Morales is the Spider-Man. We already met him in the first movie. And now he is joining forces with Gwen Stacy, who is a spider girl or spider woman, or I'm not sure how exactly what her title is. But anyway, she comes from another dimension. She joined Miles Morales in the first movie to help kind of like fix the multiverse. She's back, but now it's actually Miles who's grown up, or at least a little grown up, who rekindles his relationship with Gwen Stacy and discovers that she's actually part of a whole team of spider people from different realities, from different areas of the multiverse. And one of them is actually Miguel O'Hara, who is from World 2099, I think. And of course, all these different spider people are taken from the original comics that also apparently have all these different, you know, wasn't there even like a spider pork or something like that? Anyway, so they use the very rich comic book history of the Spider-Man franchise to kind of fuel the stories in a very, very creative way. But so apparently Gwen Stacy is now part of this kind of, you could say, like a police group that is, it's kind of unclear exactly at first what they're doing, but Miles knows he wants in. He wants to be part of that. He feels very lonely. He's struggling, of course, with the relationship with his parents who don't know that he is actually Spider-Man. And he feels not really appreciated for who he is. All the teen angst stuff is in there. And he feels like he wants to belong, just like Gwen Stacy. Why is he excluded? Turns out that actually has to do with his role in the state of the Spider-Verse. I'm not going to spoil it any more than I've already done. So there is this frantic race. It's like a roller coaster journey through all these different dimensions and ultimately, it ends, of course, in an anticipation of the closure of this story. How is this all going to end? We're going to see this in the third movie, which I think will come out next year. I'm not sure. So what did I think of the movie? I loved Into the Spider-Verse because it was so new. It also had a very, very compelling story with some like very unexpected twists in there. So the good guys turned out to be bad guys and lots of stuff that totally turned everything you expect of a Spider-Man movie upside down. So I really loved how creative it was. There was also a lot of humor in that first movie. The second movie, I have mixed feelings. I'm still in awe of what they pulled off, I think, in terms of animation quality. This is even like another league compared to the first one that was already groundbreaking. But that strength is also its weakness. Because I felt at times, and I'd love to hear what you think if you've seen it, but I felt that sometimes it was just so much and so over the top that the actual, like, it felt like I was in a blender, a visual blender. And it was like turned up to the max. And there was just so much visual information to process that it distracted me of the story. And it took me away from the emotions of the main characters. And I even felt, but I've only seen it last week, so usually it takes me a while to kind of let it sink in and maybe I have to rewatch it again. But I felt that the story was also a bit weaker than the first story. I didn't feel the same thrill that I felt while watching the first one. There is a villain who is called Spot, I think. Or The Spot. No, not Spot. I'm not talking about Data's cat, who is incidentally also called Spot. No, this is a guy who actually is covered in spots, and each spot is like a gaping black hole that connects to other parts of the Spider-Verse. It's complicated. It's very, very weird and almost experimental the way in which they picture this or they visualize this. So he's a big villain. And all the other spider people also have their own visual styles, even sometimes their own frame rates, which is cool in theory. In practice, it was so much. Like, my brain just couldn't process it. Some characters. So everyone in that was this was already the case in the first movie, but in this second movie is the same thing. It's animated not frame by frame, but every second frame, I think. So it gives it this slightly. If you've seen the Lego movie, it's similar. Like the Lego movie, they wanted to make it feel as if you were watching like a hand animated, like fan Lego movie, and they achieve this effect by making the animation itself a little bit more like blockier, more, I don't know, as if you're watching like a series of stills. This movie has that too, but then there are other frame rates. It's just, even that was messing with my brain. And it's also incredibly colorful. And it's just, it's too much. I don't know. Maybe it's because I'm an old guy. I don't know what you think, but I think that this movie actually also came out in 3D. I think my brain would have exploded like an egg in a microwave if I had seen this in 3D. I think that my body would still be there. My head would just have been plastered all over the. I don't think you want me to describe it any further. You get what I want to say. But seriously, I'm getting too old for this kind of stuff. So I don't know about the third movie. I'm, of course, going to watch it. Maybe I'll rewatch this one another time. But I'm also, I hope that this is also going to calm down. I'd like to see like a regular animated movie. And another thing, and this may be also just fatigue, is I'm kind of done with the multiverses. Right? It's just like every superhero movie now needs to have a multiverse. And I can see the attraction. I think I can see also the marketing magic that it does, because you can bring in other actors, like the way they did that with the last Tobey Maguire. But bring back Tobey Maguire and what's his name, the other Spider-Man, and just combine them all in one movie. Thanks to the Spider-Verse, I'm so happy that they did. But now I'm kind of, can we please go back to just one universe and just make stories a little bit simpler? I don't know. I'm very curious to see, if we're switching universes here, what James Gunn is going to do with his reboot of the DC universe. So James Gunn has posted, he's very active on social media. Thankfully, he's no longer on X. I'm very grateful that he stepped away from it, because now he is actually one of the engines for instance, for Threads. Lots of people are following him on Threads. He's also on Blue Sky, I think. So anyway, I'm not sure if he is on Mastodon, which is where I tend to hang out the most. Although I really like Threads as well. But anyway, so he's posting a lot. He's answering a lot of questions. There was this photo that he commented on, which made me laugh so much. So there was this so-called spy photo, and it was showed two photographers taking pictures of the actor who's going to portray Superman, I forgot his name, in full costume. And then someone asked James Gunn, is this real? And he's like, let's see. So that guy who is like looks like a blue blob and is taking a photo on a square cell phone through a hole in his cap, and then the other guy who is taking photos also with a cell phone, is like his hip is in a 90 degree angle to the rest of his body, plus it's unclear why his hands are made out of gelatin. What do you think? Is this real? So it was just another AI fake image. And I think this discussion is probably going to be with us for the unforeseeable future, because AI is getting, of course, smarter and smarter. These photos that are fake are getting more and more believable. And so this reality check or this fact check, is this real? Can we trust our eyes? I think is going to be a very important, also an ethical question for us. Can we really trust what we see? We always relied on our senses to judge whether we should believe something or not. And already the past couple of years behind us, this has become more and more difficult. You have to do much more work to figure out whether something that you read or even hear is reliable, because AI can totally fake even video, can totally fake your voice. You may be listening to my voice, but it's talking about completely different stuff. It's very easy now to create an extremely realistic looking voice. So that AI technology, of course, is unstoppable, but we should teach people and we should learn ourselves how to distinguish and how to discern whether or not to believe something. So anyway, that's a bit of a different discussion. But James Gunn showed the first photo of the Superman logo. So the first photo that we get of part of the costume of Superman, and the costume is always a big thing, you know. Everybody's always eager to see what does the costume look like. Are we going to move away from this kind of very desaturated look that we had in the last few movies where Superman played a part, where it was all, of course, kind of drained of color, very dark, very gloomy. Is it going to be garish or even retro? Are they going to go back to the pajama, you know, red swim shorts look? Or is there going to be a belt or not? We don't know, because the only close-up that we've seen is of the Superman logo itself, which looks like something that is similar to the... there's this very famous DC illustrator. Is there Ross in his name as well? I don't know. I don't remember. But anyway, I remember that when I first really started to discover how big the DC universe was when I was in Atlanta many, many years ago, and a good friend of mine was a massive DC fan, and he showed me the books that he had with these very realistic-looking, almost painting-like depictions of the DC heroes. I'm blanking out on what the name was of the artist and also of that particular era in the DC comics. But my goodness, it did look so amazing. And this particular style of the logo, even the colors, reminded me of that era. And if they go for that look, I'm all in. That is the kind of superhero look that I love. And I think it looks even better than what Marvel has been doing, because even the Marvel movies are kind of cheap looking from time to time, a bit desaturated. There's this kind of bland look that they keep doing over and over again. And I think it is because these movies have to be produced quickly and there's not much quality control. Alex Ross, thank you, Mike. This is why I'm so glad that I have a live audience watching me on all these different platforms, because I'm getting stuck, I don't know something, and then there's always an expert in my audience. So Alex Ross, just Google him, Alex Ross, Superman, you'll see what I mean. It's amazing. So what is interesting about this glimpse of the costume of Superman is that the logo with the S, which is, I think, not an S, it represents something else in Krypton culture, but I forgot what, is surrounded by snow. And when I saw that, I was like, oh, Fortress of Solitude. I am so excited. And this is because the Fortress of Solitude, of course, we're familiar with that from the early Superman movies. This is the place where Superman goes if he wants to go on a retreat. Life in New York is a little bit too busy, and he just wants to think, or he wants to look through his archives. He's got lots of statues and samples from other planets. There's just a ton that he keeps there. It's somewhere, you know, all hidden away in the icy world of the, is it North Pole? I think it is. And but we haven't seen the Fortress of Solitude in the more recent movies. But this was one of my favorite sequences in the original Donner movies, where you would actually see Superman standing there. Marlon Brando, remember him? He was playing Kal-El. Was it Kal-El or whatever? His dad, who was like holographically appearing on all these ice crystals. I thought it looked fantastic. I'd never seen something as impressive as that set. And now they're probably bringing back the Fortress of Solitude. This feels really, really good. And another thing is, it's not just going to be about Superman. Superman is, of course, the main character, but he's going to lead a team of other famous DC heroes. And if you want to know more about that, of course, I'm not an expert, check out Screen Crush on YouTube. They've got a very cool theory just based on that one photo, but just explaining, well, on the photo and on the cast list, what this story might be about. And I listened to the podcast the other day, the podcast version of the video, and I got so excited. I was like, this could really get me over, maybe I shouldn't say this in public, but this could actually move me from the world of Marvel to the world of DC. This is like confessing to an audience of Mac users that I'm switching back to Android. It's very, very risky. Anyway, I love all superheroes, but cool? This is so cool. Anyway, hopefully no multiverse. I'm done with multiverses. It's like, please, give me a good story. And sometimes you, in order to tell a good story, you need to simplify it. This is what I experienced myself writing my diary of a media priest. So this is a fun project that I started 2 weeks ago now. So I wanted to create a newsletter, because one of the issues that I have with social media, or not really an issue, but a problem that I have, is I reach out to so many people. And right now, as I'm recording this, you don't know if you're just listening to the audio podcast, but I'm always recording this live on Monday, right, at 6 p.m. Central European time. So there are now people watching on Twitch, YouTube, Facebook, LinkedIn, and Instagram. So this is the first time in my life that I'm actually streaming live to Instagram. I hope that I'll be able to stream to TikTok in the near future. But potentially tens of thousands of people are able to join me every week for this appointment. But then they're gone. Then they just move on. Or even while they're watching this, they may just scroll away and they're gone. So what I want to do is to have a longer relationship with these people and to be able to tell them about upcoming projects or invite them back. And that's why I created my Diary of a Media Priest, in which I hate classic email newsletters. They're so boring and they're so kind of salesy and they all look the same. Everything that MailChimp churns out has this certain, it looks nice, but if you've seen one, you've seen them all. And usually those email newsletters just have like a paragraph of information and then a link to whatever podcast I should check out or blog article. And then the entire newsletter consists of, we posted this show, click here. We have this article, click here. And I never do. I barely even open those emails. And usually the title is like email newsletter from, I don't know, The Verge or whatever. And I've turned like email newsletter blind. At the same time, I do acknowledge how powerful it is to be able to send people an email, like a personal email, knowing exactly that those people who have signed up to receive those messages are part of your core audience. They like what you do. They want to stay informed. So how do I do this the right way? I just thought, what would I like to read? And personally, I like to be entertained. I love it. I'm following this one journalist, and he is currently stationed in Rome. And he writes every week, he writes a newsletter, which is pretty classic in its form. But the first part of the newsletter is just a story, something that he's seen. It could be about the Pope who's getting ill, or speculation about who's going to be the next Pope, or local stuff. I don't know. There's always a little story. It's very well written. It's not too long. You read it in like 2 or 3 minutes. But I'm always looking forward to seeing the next update, because it's like a friend who sends me an update on what he has seen or experienced. And I was like, I want to do that. I don't even care for the rest of the email newsletter. I don't need to plug my podcast. People are subscribed or they're not. I don't need to send people to my TikTok videos. My TikTok viewers know that they have clicked on, yes, I want to follow this guy. And whenever I have a new video, it will hopefully turn up on their For You page. So I don't need to plug anything. But what I do want is to tell stories. I want to entertain people. I want to convey a little bit of how cool it is to be a priest working in the media. And so I'm starting to write these stories. And the more I write, I think the more I realize, first of all, how difficult it is to write a good story, but also how much a story has to leave out most of what you would normally want to say. So here on these podcasts, it's just me blabbing. I know that I have to stop after an hour. That's about it. But when I'm writing an email, I know that I only have these people. It's kind of more similar to what I do on TikTok. On TikTok, I know that I have people for 1 or 2 minutes, and that's it. So in 1 or 2 minutes, I need to grab their attention. I need to pull them in, and I need to give them so much fuel that they will keep watching until the very last second. With email newsletters, very much the same. The title is my hook. That's the equivalent of the first 2 seconds on TikTok. So that title needs to be enticing and make people curious. At the same time, that's what a lot of marketing companies also try to do. So how do you make it interesting and without it being too clickbaity? So you don't want to push people away because you're overdoing it. It's that very fine balance that there's only one way to master it, and that is by just trying it out, looking at the stats, how many people are opening the email, how many people click on the button, etc. This is how I'm trying to become good at this. But it's a different ball game because I have to be so restrained in how I tell that story and how do I condense it. So to give you an example, this last Sunday, I wrote a story about my visit to Matamata. Matamata is on the northern island of New Zealand. And it's a special place for me because that is where you can find the Lord of the Rings / Hobbit movie set. So Peter Jackson built the Shire, Hobbiton basically, in the middle of nowhere. It's out there in the open fields of the northern island. It's pretty far away. You have to go there by car, and then they will bring you in a van to the actual location. What is so cool is that all the hobbit holes are still there. It looks exactly what you saw in the movie, but instead of the 5 minutes that you get in the movie, you can walk around there for an hour. You get a tour. They tell you about not just about Hobbiton and hobbit culture, but also about how the movies got made there. You learn a lot about what happened there. And it's just so incredible to be in the same place where these movies that are now classic movies have been filmed. This is why it's like Star Wars, A New Hope. Imagine, and you can actually, you could go to Tunisia, to the place where they filmed the Beru homestead, where Luke is using his binoculars to try to find R2-D2, who has escaped, and then on Beru is, Luke, make sure that the protocol droid talks Bocce, or whatever. You know, these the remainders of those sets are still there in the desert. They're in very poor shape. But what if that had been filmed somewhere in the desert in Nevada or something like that in the U.S.? It would have been a theme park. Everybody would want to go there and just take a selfie with those buildings in the background. That's what you get on Northern Ireland. So anyway, been there. And last Sunday, I always tell stories in my homilies as well. So I came up with, like, well, I just published this Hobbit book about Lent. I'm going to do a homily that is Hobbit-themed. It's a bit of a risk because you never know if the people in church actually like that kind of story. You know, usually I tell a story just from my personal experience because it's got a broader appeal, but I was like, oh, what the heck, I'm just going to talk about hobbits. So I told the story about my visit to the Hobbiton film set. There was this one guy in the couch bus who was listening to this very loud music on his headphones, and it shut him off of the rest of the group. But it was so loud that people stayed away from him because it breaks the immersion. You feel all of a sudden you're not there. And so at one point he was reminded of the rules. You cannot make music that disturbs the other guests. And it was basically a little story to introduce my listeners in church to the theme of the Ten Commandments and what's the gospel where Jesus is chasing everyone from the temple because he says the temple should be a place of prayer, not of commerce. And so I wanted to emphasize that the rules are not just to to harass us and to be a pain in the you know what. But rules are there. They're like a fence. They want to protect something valuable. And in this case, in the Shire, it was to protect the immersion. And if you have that modern music, then it takes you out of the Shire. You're no longer in Middle Earth. You're just like walking around with a group of people with this young guy with all this, you know, music. So anyway, that was about a 15-minute homily. It was a bit long. But then after Mass, I sat down and was like, oh, I think I can write a story based on this for my diary. Why not? So I recounted the story. But then I had to bring it down from a story that took 15 minutes in church to something you can read in 3 minutes. That was so hard. That was really tough. And even after posting it, I still felt like, it misses something. I think the next story I got to do better. It's got to be even more engaging. It has to keep you on the edge of your seat. I don't know exactly how to do that, but it's all in the mastery of reducing it. And this is to bring it back to the whole discussion about superhero movies. I feel like with the multiverse, these superhero movies have become so bloated. You need to do so much homework to understand what's going on in Ant-Man. It's like, good grief, can we please just tell a good story? I don't mind if the movie is just an hour and a half. As long as it's a story that touches me and that reaches me, I don't need the multiverse for that. I just need a good story. So anyway, I'll get off my soapbox now. Let's maybe move over to the next topic. I'm going to press a button and I don't know what's going to happen. Let's see. Oh, this is the jingle for the Peculiar Bunch.
Catholics rock!
So what is the Peculiar Bunch? Well, this is the place where you can ask anything you always wanted to know about Catholics, but you are afraid to ask.
Catholics can be a peculiar bunch. No meat on Friday.
No meat? What do they eat, light bulbs?
And on today's Peculiar Bunch, I want to talk about something that I don't like about the current Pope. And it's not what you think.
Man, you guys got more crazy rules than Blockbuster Video.
If you've been listening to my podcast for a while, you know that I'm a very, very big fan of Pope Francis. I love his incredible talent for communication. He really knows how to capture an audience, how to keep everybody engaged. And even when he has to read a text that someone else wrote for him, every once in a while, he'll just stop and he'll look at the crowd and he's like, are you guys still awake? Little things like that. It's genius. But there is one thing that I actually don't like about some of his more recent behavior. And again, it's not what you think. So I know that this Pope has a lot of critics. And some of them are extremely vocal. They don't like his perceived liberal position on a number of things. Sometimes it's also because they just don't get it. They don't understand why the Pope is pushing certain issues and not talking about other stuff. I don't want to get into that, but there's this one thing that I see in the Pope's behavior that I think is actually something that I hope he will change. And it has to do with his health. So Pope Francis, as you know, is in his 80s. He's older than President Biden in the United States, a number of years older than Donald Trump. And you know, if you follow the politics in the United States, how much debate there is about the ancient age of these leaders that are, you know, shouldn't we go? Like, it always baffled me that in the U.S. you have so many politicians who are at an age where in the Netherlands they'd be sitting at a table in a care home watching TV. We don't have politicians after retirement age. I don't know any of them. Anyway, so, but if you think that Biden or Trump are old, then of course the Pope, who is the leader of a billion-member religious community, is even older. And of course, Pope Francis is mentally extremely alert. There are no signs whatsoever of cognitive decline. On the contrary, to me, it appears that he's getting sharper and sharper every year. But physically, his health has been degrading over the last few years. He had, of course, he always had some respiratory issues because when he was young, they removed a lung or part of his lungs. So he tends to be a bit short of breath. But more seriously, he had more and more trouble walking. And this is because his knee is maybe also the hip is used up. And he's got a lot of pain because of that. And so nowadays he prefers to be wheeled around in a regular wheelchair. Now, of course, he's not the only pope who has had this. Pope, his two predecessors, John Paul II and Pope Benedict XVI, also at the end of their pontificate, as we call the job of being pope, they were also experiencing a lot of trouble walking around. But they had, Pope John Paul II had the Pope Mobile, and Benedict XVI, he even had like an entire platform that he would just stand on and they would just push him around like that. Pope Francis is more like, it's a bit like his cars. He doesn't like to be run around in big, expensive cars. So he'll just use like any car. It doesn't matter if it's a small one. And the same thing with his trouble walking. He's just like, just give me a wheelchair. And it's simple, but it works. But here's the thing. He is more and more frequently, he has a fever. He had pneumonia a while ago. And then he's rushed to the hospital. They do their examinations. And it's always kind of the same PR strategy as the Vatican. Like, he's got a mild cold. Nothing is wrong. He's going to be okay. His doctor has told him to take it easy. And usually, that's the end of it. And every time he is released from the hospital, journalists are asking, but Holy Father, how are you doing? And he's like quipping, like, well, Mom, I'm still alive. Some of you might not like it, but I'm still here. I'm not retiring anytime soon. The issue that I see in this is the Pope is oftentimes, especially this past week, I've seen this, he is literally pushing himself to appear at, like, the Wednesday audience, on Sunday at the window for the Angelus prayer. He's meeting tons and tons of dignitaries, politicians, football teams, soccer teams, sorry, America. And at the same time, we know that he's ill. He has a fever. He has a bronchitis. He admits it himself. So sometimes he will just hand over his speech to an aide, and he says, like, I have bronchitis. I don't feel well. Let someone else. But he's still showing up. And why do I think that this is not the right thing to do? It is because maybe he himself has the character like, I'm pushing through. I'll just use willpower. I want to be there. It's important. I'll die, in service. We all know people like that. Like, I'm not sick. I'm not feeling well. But what I think is the issue here is that we are currently dealing with a lot of priests and even bishops that are suffering very severe burnout. I know a ton of them here in my own country. This is an unspoken issue. A lot of priests, even religious women, men, anyone who works in a church that is shrinking, that has to deal with a very complex situation where you have to take care of people on a very personal level, which requires so much dedication. At the same time, a lot of these people in the church also need to run the church as an organization, as a manager. Some of my priest friends in the United States even run entire schools. Like, they're literally managing a school. None of that is part of our formation. They still are tasked to do this. And then there is the public perception that a priest should always be there for people. You cannot be sick. You cannot have an off day. You cannot have a day where you show up for Mass and you're like, yeah, dear brothers and sisters, I know that you're all expecting a homily, but I've got a headache and I'm tired and I had no inspiration. You're not supposed to say that. You are still supposed to show up. And I know that a lot of my colleagues are pushing through. They are pushing themselves to the brink of total exhaustion. And this is not just a physical problem. It's also a mental problem. This is making you feel basically impossible to be sick. It makes you feel, you position yourself as the savior. And if you're not there, everything crumbles. That's what you tell yourself. I know this from my personal experience because I've suffered a burnout in my first years as a priest. And I recognize the same behavior with my colleagues and no one stops them. I have dealt with a number of people above me, so bishops and other people in the church, the kind of the governing or management part of the church, that always gave this example that you have to offer it up. You have to push through. Even if you're sick, you're still going to be there. It's just willpower. And I'm thinking that is setting such a wrong example. It's setting the bar so high that we're supposed to follow the example of the people above us, right? And this was already happening in the seminary, where we saw the same tenacity of the teachers. And yeah, I'm actually sick, but I'm still going to show up for prayer. And I was always, even as a young student, I was like, if you're sick, you should be in bed. That's what I learned. You might infect other people. I've seen this during COVID. Like priests would still celebrate Mass even though they knew that they had COVID. Like totally irresponsible. And I think personally that the Pope should set the right example. If he has bronchitis, if he runs a fever, he should be in bed. Or at least he should just watch TV. But the problem is, this is a very stubborn Pope. he's a Jesuit. And he knows what he wants, but there's no one, of course, around him that tells him, that's a great plan, but we're not going to do that. You're going to stay in your room. We're going to bring you like hot porridge and a nice drink and a cup of tea, and you're going to put your feet on the couch, and you're just going to watch Rick and Morty all day long. No one tells the Pope that. I don't think that even if there was someone who would tell him, they probably wouldn't advise him watching Rick and Morty, but I would. I would just enjoy yourself. Go watch a few movies or whatever. And the Pope doesn't. He's always there, and we know that he's sick, and he might actually collapse. This is, at his age, this is very risky behavior. And for too long, I think this kind of chosen martyrdom has been shown to the world as, this is the example. Look at how virtuous these priests and these bishops are by sacrificing their own health to be with their people. And I'm thinking, you know what? There are so many other ways to be a martyr these days. You don't have to look for it. You don't have to create it. Just try to be a good priest and you will have your share of the cross, you know. But don't set the example and think that doesn't make a difference. I think that priests are getting the wrong signal here. And I believe personally, again, from personal experience, that it's super important. If you want to take care of other people, you also are obliged. I think it's a moral obligation to take good care of yourself. If you are sick, you are not able to help someone else. If you don't take care of yourself, how can you take care of other people? This is true for priests. It's also true for parents. How many parents are constantly like, I need to be there for my kids, otherwise, well, no, you don't need to be perfect. Kids are flexible. And if you constantly show by your own example that you have to always push yourself over your boundaries, these kids will never learn that you're actually limited. There will be times in your life where you want to do something, but you can't. And you have to listen to yourself and you have to respect yourself. Lots and lots of thoughts about this, but I'll talk about this at some other time because we need to wrap this show up. Thank you so much for the privilege of your time. And if you are one of my patrons, of course, there's more to come because I create an extra spicy, extra juicy, extra long version of the break each week. And the only way in which you get access to that particular version of the break is by joining my Patreon community on patreon.com/FatherRoderick. Whatever you do, I hope you sign up for my email newsletter. It's a lot of fun to write, and I love, by the way, the feedback. If my stories are boring you, tell me. Tell me, you know, I like this story, I don't like this story, because that helps me to improve. And it's free. And you get my Lent for Little Folk, my Hobbit Lenten guide, for free as well. Just go to mediapriest.com/Lent. Mediapriest.com/Lent. And if you're already subscribed to my newsletter and for some reason didn't get the link, just wait for the next story. Underneath the story, there will be a link for the next couple of weeks to my Hobbit book. So, hope you all are able to check it out. Again, thanks for watching, thanks for listening, and may the Force be with you. Live long and prosper. What does Frodo tell Gandalf? Or, I don't know. Take care.